From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Herbert Marcuse was a major figure in the social and intellectual milieu of the 60s and 70s, a German-born political thinker and philosopher who became a hero to many boomers who were political activists in that era. There appears to be a Marcuse revival with a number of books on him and his work recently coming out. In the hour ahead, we discuss the life and work of Herbert Marcuse after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. In this hour of Forum, we focus our attention on a figure who was iconic in the 60s and early 70s, Herbert Marcuse, a German-born theorist, intellectual, author, and academic, who espoused a new political theory that was embraced by many of the activists and protesters who were drawn to the work of the social thinker and radical philosopher. Marcuse gave us such books as Reason and Revolution, Eros and Civilization, and One-Dimensional Man, and his work combined Marx and Freud and existentialism and a theory based on ideas of liberation and opposition to conformity and capitalist hegemony. He became a cult figure to the left both here in the United States and in Europe and was said to have been the author of the famous bumper sticker line, "Make Love, Not War." Those under 30 who are listening to us likely don't know or recognize the name of Marcuse or have any familiarity with his work, but his work has come into a kind of revival with publication recently of a couple of books, and we thought we'd look at who he was and the ideas that once helped shape a political and social counterculture. And let me tell you who is joining us. We want to welcome first Douglas Kellner, who is George F. Kellner, philosophy of education chair at UCLA, author of Toward a Critical Theory of Society, the collected papers of Herbert Marcuse, and joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome.
Welcome, Michael.
Glad to have you with us. Also glad to have William Leese, who is a scientist with the McLaughlin Center for Population Health Risk Assessment, Institute of Population Health at the University of Ottawa, and co-author with Andrew Feinberg of The Essential Marcuse, Selected Writings of Philosopher and Social Critic Herbert Marcuse. And William Leese joins us from Ottawa, and we welcome you. Good morning.
Thank you.
We also have with us this morning Peter Marcuse, who is Herbert Marcuse's son, Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at Columbia, and also the literary executor of the Marcuse Estate, and he joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome, Peter Marcuse.
Hello.
Also say hello to Ocean Newman, who's here with us in studio, artist, social justice lawyer in the East Bay Community Law Center, also lived with Herbert Marcuse for several years and has the distinction of having had having been the stepson as well as the brother-in-law of Herbert Marcuse, which, as I said, perhaps could be a story and saga in itself. And welcome, Ocean Newman.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Maybe let's begin with you. Just give us a sense of this Frankfurt School that Herbert Marcuse belonged to, Theodor Adorno and Walter Benjamin. What were they all about?
Well, I guess the term wasn't in use at that time, but I think it might have been called a think tank these days. And it was a group of intellectuals, mostly Jewish, who were unaffiliated politically, Marxist theoreticians who were very much into, grew out of Hegel, influenced a lot by the Marx of the 1848 manuscripts, and explored issues of Freud and popular culture. They enlarged the traditional Marxism. They were neither communists nor most of them democratic socialists. They really were unaligned. And when Hitler came to power, many of them came to the United States in this sort of great immigration of intellectuals from there, Max Horkheimer, Theodor Adorno, Herbert, and established themselves in the United States.
They came out of also, I think it's important to note, struggle against fascism.
And absolutely.
In fact, Marcuse worked for the government for a while doing anti-Nazi propaganda.
Both my father, Franz Neumann, who was also a member of the school, and Herbert did work for the OSS, actually the predecessor of the CIA, doing research on Germany. And yeah, the central issue in their lives was fascism. How is it that in the center of this of a democracy and a culture that actually many of them very much admired, barbarism could suddenly spring up. How to explain that, how to understand it, how to theorize it. It was constantly the issue for them.
It seems to many ways of thinking, Peter Marcuse, that the ideas of your father that came out of this anti-fascism that we're talking about here, or at least were steeped in a sense of countering fascism and fighting fascism, and the idealism that grew out of his thinking and the thinking of the Frankfurt School, maybe you're a little bit not as relevant today, or maybe not relevant at all. I mean, so that argument goes. And what would you say to that?
I would say that the times have changed again, and that that it's time for, I wouldn't call it idealism. My father always felt that that what was ideally desirable was also practically realizable. And I think it is again. I think you see it in the what's sometimes called the anti-globalization movement. I think I was very pleased to hear Sarkozy in one of his early comments after being elected as a conservative president in France, saying it was time to be done with 68. 68, of course, being the year in which what my father stood for really blossomed on the streets and in the colleges and around the world. And if Sarkozy is saying it's time to be done with it, it means it's still around.
Well, it's not only the countering of fascism that may still be around or, you know, maybe mushrooming in different ways. Your father's ideas were all about the technocratic threat. I mean, that was implicit in One-Dimensional Man, and that was a seminal work of his, all about a one-dimensional society. And many would feel that that has a great deal of relevance to today's world.
It does indeed. I get at least once a month a request for a reprint of work of his. And what just crossed my desk was a request to reprint an early piece of his on the role of technology in structuring the kind of society we now live in.
It's also, I think, important to point out, especially younger listeners who, as I said, probably don't recognize most of them, the name Herbert Marcuse, you know, that we may be talking about a remoteness of utopian times where his vision is concerned, but he was someone who really built ideas that were very much connected to the connection between the personal and the political.
Yes, that also. If we have a moment, I'd love to read to you a comment that somebody made at the protest against the G8 meeting in northern Germany just this last week.
Sure, if it's short, go ahead.
Because it's so much a reprise of what he was saying. Our time, this is our time, not theirs, ours. A time of intensity, a time of passion, a time of dreams, a time of breaking time, a time in which we refuse all continuity, a time for making the world anew. We shall dance to dawn and beyond it if we want to. Their time is the time of a clock that ticks the seconds of death, the time of continuity that says, obey today, obey tomorrow. That's not our time. And that's very much in the spirit of my father.
That's a spirit that continues to scare a lot of people. I mean, because it's also tied to a freedom from repression and a kind of elevation of the pleasure principle, at least a lot of his thinking is.
Well, there is going to be in Atlanta in 2 days a meeting of, they expect, 10,000 to 20,000 people of the United States Social Forum, which is an offshoot of the World Social Forum, which is a worldwide movement that's dedicated to this kind of an idea that that we don't want to obey, we want to be free.
Talking to Peter Marcuse, Herbert Marcuse's son, who is Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at Columbia. And William Leese is also with us, and William Leese studied with Professor Marcuse at Brandeis and at University of California, San Diego, and is the author of a book on with Andrew Feinberg called The Essential Marcuse, Selected Writings of Philosopher and Social Critic Herbert Marcuse. We should mention that Lowell Bergman, locally, who many of you know, was also a student of Herbert Marcuse. So was Angela Davis, another local
Correct.
Name that's well-known. Tell us something. He was supposed to be a great teacher. Tell us something about his teaching.
Yes, that's less well-known than the man who became famous for the big speeches to the anti-war movement. I'm the last one left to had the good fortune of work with them both at Brandeis and UC San Diego. In fact, I never wanted to leave. They had to sort of throw me out after 9 years in graduate school because it was so wonderful, both the times, but also just the experience. Partly, I like to tell people, it's because he wasn't the type of individual who, when he became very famous, and he became very famous only very late in life, I mean, really only after One Dimensional Man, he was already 66 years old when it was published. He didn't change at all in terms of the people who were working with him. And he allowed a kind of intimacy and friendship with graduate students, even while making sure we did the work we were supposed to do. That was quite remarkable for the time. But he was a great lecturer. He's a great seminar leader. And he carried on here in San Diego, especially because we spent all our time during the day in the Free Speech Plaza on the anti-war activity. And then the seminars were in the evening. And he never made it easy. He refused to teach Marx. He said that was too easy. So we had to do Hegel, and we had to do the hardest Hegel of all, the Greater Logic. And so after working all day agitating, the seminar door would close, the outside world would disappear. So I'd open the book, read the first line, tell me what you think it means. And seminars lasted 3 hours. We got through 5 pages. Seminar lasted 20 weeks. We got through 100 pages. But after that, you knew how to read.
Well, let's talk about the relevance of what came out of that education for you, of his thought and ideas. Some would say, you know, this is an esoteric artifact of the 60s, and yet here you are involved in all kinds of work on behalf of climate change, at least studying it, population, health care up there in Canada. How does this tie back to your education?
Well, when you have that intense in education never leaves you, even when you go on to do different types of work, although I do both still some of the theory too. It would be hard to explain the kind of inspiration. I mean, if you have to go back and read Plato's Symposium to get the feel for that type of intensity of experience of teacher and student, a group of students and teacher, it's like it was yesterday. I mean, it's partly the inspiration. I mean, you were aware that this was someone whose life had been on the line. He arrived in New York, I think, Peter, in sometime in the mid-30s with one suitcase. And then here we were in San Diego in the late 60s, and there were death threats against him from people in San Diego because of the anti-war activity. He was almost 70 years old. It was like all over again, and yet was not deterred, refused to have any special situation set up for himself. And it was partly just the inspiration of someone. And for us in the San Diego crowd, our perception was of his former colleagues, Adorno and Horkheimer, they had given up. And he never gave up. I mean, there's a lot wrong with the later work, but the inspiration is that he kept searching for new questions and new answers.
Well, a lot of that tribute comes through in the fact that you've done a book on his whole career that you wrote with Andrew Feinberg. Interested, though, in your response to, it's interesting, on the website for Marcuse, there is a whole section given over to haters. I suppose these are some of the people that made some of those death threats against him during the war period. David Horowitz being probably the most well-known or most prominent one. And what they have to say is that what he was about was suppression of conservative speech, and that somehow there was a kind of blacklisting that went on where those who were conservative were concerned. That was a part of Marcuse's thinking and a part of Marcuse's system of belief, I guess.
I think it's rubbish myself. I mean, I think it's a deliberate misunderstanding of some of the things that he wrote. You know, for those who actually had the experience, as opposed to those who want to make some kind of political hay out of this, the experience of learning was one of this complete openness. There was openness. There was no censorship. Nothing that could not be brought forward if you could make a good argument for it. As I say, it was one of these remarkable experiences. So I think for those guys, it's just making political hay.
Well, they also make a big deal, Peter Marcuse, of the fact that I guess he left, they say millions. I guess it was about, in terms of his estate, hundreds of thousands of dollars, though.
Oh, that's nonsense. And he left the royalties that he got on the books and some very modest speaking fees. He never charged. When he spoke for a student audience, he never charged.
I guess it's a way of certainly trying to at least blacken the sort of criticism that he had of capitalism, but he was also critical of communism.
Yes. Well, a criticism of the kind of communism that that called itself communism that was prevalent in under state socialism in Eastern Europe.
Like Susan Sontag said, you couldn't sometimes tell the difference because they were both so totalitarian. I want to go to Douglas Kellner, who is George F. Kellner Philosophy of Education Chair at UCLA. And you're not the scion to George Kellner. Just happen
no,
to have the
actually George F. Neller Chair.
Neller, okay.
Yes.
I just shifted a few letters there.
Right.
He's the author, by the way, Douglas Kellner is the author of Toward a Critical Theory of Society, Collected Papers of Herbert Marcuse. And there's some real treasures in this book, including an 80th birthday poem by Sam Beckett, no less.
Right.
Tell us about the sense of your devotion to Marcuse, why you collected his papers, what resonance they have for us today as well.
Well, I was a graduate student at Columbia University in philosophy in New York in the 1960s, and I read all of Marcuse's books. So I thought One-Dimensional Man was the best critique of American society at the time that I think is still relevant for social critique today. Reason and Revolution is the best book on Hegel, Marx, and social theory that I was studying. Eros and Civilization, the best on Freud, on perspectives of liberation. So when Marcuse came to the campus in 1968 and 1969, I met him, I heard his talks, and so I thought he was the most best radical critic and intellectual of the time. And in terms of his relevance for today, let me give you the advice that he gave to the left and to student activists at the time. And basically, he said, to do revolutionary practice, you need revolutionary theory. If you want to change the world, you need knowledge of the world. So he called for the study of society in what he called critical theory. And that has stayed with me today, to continue to develop critical perspectives on the present age. And I find Marcuse's work is still relevant for doing that today.
Well, here's thinking that's, Marcuse, described as a revolutionary theorist, if you just suggested, described as a utopianist, as a dialectician, as a nihilist, as a radical. Do any of those signifiers really catch or embrace what he was all about, or was he all of those things and more?
Well, he was not a nihilist. That he was a critic of radical negation. In other words, he was for human liberation. He was against repression. So he was for the great refusal, saying no, negation of anything that was a form of repression, domination, exploitation. But he was also for positive perspectives on liberation. So his utopianism was simply the dreams of a better world, which, by the way, to some extent were realized in the counterculture and the anti-war movement of the 1960s, where there was an emphasis on love, on community, on peace, on play, on all of the values that had been repressed in the conservative corporate society of the 1950s. So I think that Marcuse's utopianism had a basis in reality.
Some of his detractors have said he's the father of political correctness.
That is absolutely correct. I agree with what William Lee said earlier, that it's rubbish that Marcuse was for blacklisting, et cetera. I mean, that's what McCarthyism and the right does. Marcuse was for criticism of views that promoted militarism or sexism, racism, et cetera. But he wasn't for censorship. He was for critique, debate.
But was he one of those who suggested that, for example, only whites can be racists?
I've never heard him say that. That doesn't sound like Marcusean.
Would it be apt to describe Marcuse's thinking as cultural Marxism?
It's a form of cultural Marxism, but it also includes Freud, Hegel, Max Weber. It's a great synthesis of the radical and critical theory of the Western tradition.
Repressive tolerance is one of these phrases that's associated with Marcuse. Can you explain that or define that for us?
Repressive tolerance is saying that basically we should not be tolerant of things like the Vietnam War, or I would say today, the Iraq War. We should speak out against it. We should oppose it, that there's limits to tolerance. We should not be tolerant of racist, sexist, homophobics. We should say no to them. This is the great refusal that Marcuse is talking about. But again, it's confrontation and critique. It's not, you know, blacklisting.
So we're seeing a kind of, what do you think, you're seeing kind of a Marcuse revival with your book and William Leese and Andrew Feinberg's book, maybe getting back into the cultural bloodstream here, or a new meme, a neo-Marcuse kind of meme?
This has been going on for some time. I actually published a book in 1984 on Herbert Marcuse and the crisis of Marxism. And since then, I've been invited all over the world to Marcuse conferences in South America, in Europe, all over the U.S. In fact, there's a new international Marcuse conference that has had two conferences and is meeting again next year in Philadelphia. So there is a strong global resonance and continuation of Marcuse's books, reflected in a lot of publications in the U.S., but also in Brazil and Europe, etc. Peter Marcuse, who's the literary executor who's on your show, gets, as he said, requests for translations and publications from all over the world all the time. The other thing I would say is it's also in very many academic disciplines you have interest in Marcuse. He did philosophy. He was relevant to political science, to sociology, to media critique, to ecology, to many different topics.
Peter Marcuse, a lot of requests still coming in, huh?
Yes, yes. Can I add something to what Doug just said?
Of course.
My own field is urban planning, what to do about cities. And in that field, his name is coming up. We're doing a reading group at Columbia in which we just selected One Dimensional Man as the next book that we're going to read. And the whole idea of having a picture of where the world really ought to go, in a sense is a utopia, but also in a sense of what's really achievable today. The World Social Forum has their slogan, another world is possible. And that's pure Marcuse.
Osha Newman, you became an anarchist. Was that linked to Marcuse?
Well, I became a member of a group that you cannot say on the radio, up against the wall, mother bleepers.
Yes, I knew that group.
I think on the Lower East Side, and it was partly, much of my life has been in relation to the thinking of Herbert, but at that point, part of it also was kind of an anti-intellectual reaction, maybe an Oedipal revolt against living with this father figure of the new left. And so it was an odd situation that much of what I was doing was theorized by Herbert, but the actual practice would have appalled him. I mean, he was in some ways, you know, not a complicated person, but it was dialectic in the sense that while he was the father and the progenitor intellectually for a lot of very radical lifestyle movements, he liked a very bourgeois existence.
Well, you were part of his dialectic, at least from the sounds of it. I'm going to open up the phone lines, invite those of you to join us who may remember the work of Marcuse, how it influenced you. I'd like to hear from some young people, reactions to what they're hearing. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Join us, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Again, the number for you to call is 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This hour, discussing the legacy of Herbert Marcuse and talking about to what extent the German-born philosopher's work informs today's progressive movement. We have a whole panel here, and so I was talking with Osha Newman off air about to what extent we're talking about a different time, obviously a more utopian and galvanized time politically. And so some of this sounds a bit esoteric, perhaps to the young people who have not heard the name Herbert Marcuse, but he was a seminal figure and probably in his way the most influential radical thinker and radical theorist of his time. You could compare him, say, to someone like Noam Chomsky, but Noam Chomsky was also, of course, a linguistics professor, is a seminal figure in the world of linguistics, and probably didn't have as much influence, or hasn't had as much influence in some as Marcuse had in his day. Peter Marcuse, his son, is with us. He's now a professor emeritus of urban planning at Columbia and the executor of his literary estate, and is with us from New Haven. And William Leese, with the McLaughlin Center for Population Health Risk Assessment, Institute of Population Health, University of Ottawa, is with us from up in Ottawa. He's a co-author with Andrew Feinberg of The Essential Marcuse, Selected Writings of Philosopher and Social Critic Herbert Marcuse. Douglas Kellner is George F. Neller, Professor of Education and Chair at UCLA, author of Toward a Critical Theory of Society, Collected Papers of Herbert Marcuse, and Osha Newman, here with us in studio, is an artist and social justice lawyer in the East Bay Community Law Center, lived with Herbert Marcuse for several years, and as I said, was both a stepson and brother-in-law to Herbert Marcuse. And you want to explain that, Osha? Just
Herbert married my mother shortly after my father's death, and after my mother died, he married my wife's sister, and at that point, I had this dual relationship with him.
But let us go to our callers. And Lou, we begin with you. Good morning. You're on forum.
Good morning. This is, I don't know, it might be a strange association, but I was wondering if any of the panelists could comment on Marcuse and Trotsky in terms of their willingness to analyze and criticize social, cultural, and social thinking. Aside from the military aspect of Trotsky's life, but just in terms of cultural criticism, they seem to me to be two of the larger minds. And I was just wondering if it brings up any thoughts on the part of the panel.
Douglas Kellner, some dots connected to Trotsky from Marcuse?
Yes, Marcuse was a strong critic of the old left, particularly of the Stalinist left. So that would put him in a similar category with Trotsky. But Marcuse was also very critical of all dogmatic sects, of all political groupings that followed the line of someone like Trotsky. So he would be critical of Trotskyists. But I think that the caller's right that he had a similar sort of leftist critique of the Soviet Union and particularly of Stalinism and a particularly activist stance as Trotsky did.
Activist particularly with respect to during that time that we're talking about here, that 60s era that we're reckoning back with, militarism and a desire for social justice.
Right, but also Marcuse was not only a champion of the New Left, but of the feminist movement, of the gay and lesbian liberation movements, of black and brown power, of the ecology movements. So Marcuse had a very broad emancipatory scope of social movements. So that would also distinguish from someone like Trotsky that tends to be sort of focused on things like class or the state or militarism.
Let me go to more callers. And from Berkeley, Kathleen joins us. Morning, Kathleen.
Good morning. With the August discussion that's going on, I'm afraid my contribution is only going to be some personal memories and not nearly so philosophical.
It's an important contribution. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. My then husband was a graduate student in the philosophy department in San Diego, and so I had opportunities to meet Herbie, which is, of course, what everybody called him, at various events of the college, and was once even invited to a Passover Seder at his house. So I did want to comment this notion that he died leaving millions. He and his then-wife owned a house in La Jolla, which, of course, had appreciated over time. And if that may have at that time been worth $1 million, I suppose that's possible. But the notion that he was independently wealthy was sort of silly.
Well, his books did pretty well, Peter Marcuse, actually, didn't they?
Yes, paperback royalties aren't immense, and they are really at a trickle at this point. But, yeah, it did reasonably well. He was comfortable.
And we thank Kathleen for her call. And by the way, again, I want to we're going to go to as many of your calls as we can, but particularly like to hear from some of the younger listeners here, under 30, which during the 60s, of course, was the age that could only be trusted, supposedly, and what sort of impact some of this discussion of this important ideological figure of the 60s creates in your minds or hearts. Paul, you're on. Good morning.
Oh, hi. I have a question. My brother and I were in the anti-war movement. In fact, my two brothers and I. And we used to discuss Marcuse a lot. And I'm wondering, was there any women that were, say, on the equivalent level of Marcuse? Are there any women today? Because it's curious to me, nowadays I say, I don't trust anybody under 60. But it's curious to me that there's so few women who became famous leaders like that of the intellectual branch of the anti-war movement.
Let me actually go to you, William Lees, on this. I think when you think about women leaders ideologically from that period, you think mainly of feminists, I guess, don't you?
Yeah, that's a complicated business. I mean, as has been mentioned already, Herbert was a person who was well aware of a whole series of trends, including the feminists and so on, and encouraged that a lot and so on. But all I can say is we had in our group Angela Davis, and a remarkable person with a remarkable life. The question about numbers, it's harder to answer. There are many historical and social reasons for that. But we had in the group and at the San Diego campus, it was a pretty fair gender representation. And but one, you know, nothing's perfect in those days. Even in the new movement, the new left, and so on, there was a good deal of male chauvinism. I mean, you can't change history overnight.
It was also really, when you talk about Marcuse, you're talking about a figure who's almost sui generis, you know, to think of sort of a woman counterpart, particularly at a time when, as you say, there was a lot of male chauvinism, is fairly challenging, although we had thinkers like Germaine Greer, for example. I mean, again, in the feminist realm. Again, I'd like to hear from some of the younger listeners here. Let me just give the phone number out again. Toll free, it's 866-733-6786 or via email. Forum at kqed.org. Peter Marcuse, I think I hear your voice here.
I was going to say that Cindy Sheehan is certainly in the forefront of the anti-war movement today, and at the U.S. Social Forum, more than half of the people are women.
On we go to more calls. David, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm afraid I'm not under 30, though I feel like it, but I studied with Marcuse at Brandeis as an undergraduate a little bit. And I wanted to comment on a couple of things and see what your panelists had to say. The first is that Marcuse was a wonderful teacher, and not only of Marx and Freud, but of Western philosophers in general. He was staggeringly clear. But I'm not really persuaded that he doesn't have a little bit to do with the repression or disdain for conservative thought from the left. Certainly at Brandeis in his time, in the milieu which he helped to establish, a conservative voice could virtually not be raised. There were a very few undergraduates and perhaps graduate students who would try to voice conservative opinions, that they would simply get mobbed by, if not by Marcuse personally, by his followers. And I'm not convinced that he wasn't partly responsible for that. And I think that I would suggest that that might have been the case, and that you could see it simply from the title of his of a principal work, and that is One Dimensional Man. I always found that book contemptuous in tone of the possibilities of life as it existed, including in corporate America. And I found it far too dark and dismal, an account of possibilities, and particularly so as I moved ahead in my own life. That dark, dismal view was a problem at Brandeis in general, and it limited a lot of the kids who graduated from the school that were too wedded to that view. I'll just stop there. Well, you guys have to think of it.
Yeah, I'd like to get a response actually first from Peter Marcuse to your comments. This was a period when Gene Kirkpatrick, for example, was not allowed to speak, the conservative UN ambassador at Berkeley. And how much did you feel maybe your father might have contributed to things like that?
Well, my father always defended very strongly academic freedom and was very much against, saw the universities as a bulwark of thinking and criticism, was against much of what happened in the takeover at Columbia and so forth. But on the other hand, he was also intolerant in a way. Doug spoke of the concept of repressive tolerance. If you read what George Bush now is saying about stem cell research, it's very hard to be tolerant of that. It's very hard not to say that. That is simply absurd and not worth serious discussion. In that sense, I think there was a healthy intolerance for nonsense.
Osha Newman, you were going to say something here?
Yeah, I mean, Herbert certainly was never a yeller or somebody to shout somebody down. But this was a time when there was a sense of emergency and desperation about what was going on in the world, about the Vietnam War. And yes, people were enormously intolerant of everything that was contributing to that atrocity. And rightly so, I think. As to the pessimism of one-dimensional man, I mean, I think in some ways maybe it was not pessimistic enough. I mean, the last sentence of that book is a quotation that I think he got from Walter Benjamin, that only for those without hope is hope given. And I think that kind of dialectic was very much, he was, on the one hand, a person who supported all these very optimistic movements of the 60s, but also was deeply realistic. And I think he would have appreciated, Peter mentioned Cindy Sheehan, Cindy Sheehan's despair, you know, that there's a reality and a truth about that, that he, and out of that comes a certain amount of hope.
I'm thinking of Beckett again, you know, hope yes, for the rest
right.
of them, but
whom
not
loved.
For us, or something right. along those lines. So let me thank David for his call, and we'll get more of your calls on here. AJ, good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay.
So I'm actually an under 30 listener here. This is very fascinating. I've never heard of Herbert, and this is really neat. And a lot of what he, you know, what resonates with me in many ways because of the war and things like this. I kind of want to know, like, you know, what would the panelist say is kind of, how would you describe him in just a couple of words? I know it's a very simplistic view, but, you know, you're at a cocktail. What's kind of the tagline or party line to describe Herbert? Is he a critic? Is he a radicalist? Is he kind of a pseudo-social Marxist? I mean, how would you kind of, you know, put him in a party line, if you will?
How would you pigeonhole him? Now, Douglas Kellner, you want to take a shot at that?
Well, a critical theorist, that was the term that he always identified with, that critique is so important, but also a radical theorist of getting to the roots of repression and domination, and finally, a liberationist, someone that is striving for human liberation on both a personal and a political and social level.
Well, here's an email from a listener who says, in his seminal book, Terrorism and the Liberal State, Paul Wilkinson depicts Herbert Marcuse as an apologist for terrorism.
Oh, nonsense.
That is, yeah.
I'd just like to add a lighter note to what Doug just said. Also, a mischievous critical theorist.
Okay.
Those who knew had an incredible sense of humor.
Right.
I mean, we were often in stitches. It was wonderful experience just to be around him.
Well, what was his view on violence? I mean, this was a time when you had sort of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, you know, dividing the whole line. We saw it on a number of occasions come into play in Spike Lee's film, for example, Do the Right Thing. Was he, as most revolutionaries, someone who countenanced violence if it was a necessary way of bringing about revolutionary change?
He was personally deeply committed to nonviolence,
yeah.
And the ultimate goal of liberation was a nonviolent, violent world. That was the end.
But
however, in
to
order to get
world,
there,
yeah,
this was right. a time when you had revolutions you could believe in. You had Che Guevara. We actually could the NFL the in
we're not
Vietnam.
Talking football here.
No, know. No, we're talking the National Liberation Front in Vietnam was a movement that we could rightly or wrong, we may have romanticized it, but we could have identified with it. And yes, I mean he understood that. He wrote actually to Angela Davis when she was in jail for after being arrested for allegedly being involved in the George Jackson issue.
Civic Center. Yeah.
Reminding her of how she'd written about Frederick Douglass and how he achieved his liberation by decking a slave master, hitting him and knocking him down, and how the slave master then called on the other slaves to rise up, and they wouldn't. And that was where liberation and freedom came together. But ultimately and personally, he hated a violence. I mean, he was for, in the end, a sort of a polymorphous perversity, a kind of a soft hippopotamus. He loved hippopotami.
Yes,
not the actual hippopotamus, which is a quite violent animal, but sort of the image of a hippopotamus.
Sexual freedom. Actually, polymorphous perversity is Freud's phrase, but sexual freedom in the
Michael,
sense of liberating.
Let me add, if I may, a word on terrorism, because it's such a prevalent issue these days. He was asked to write an op-ed for the New York Times at the time of the Weathermen and some so-called revolutionary violence in Germany, kidnapping and so forth. And he
it was the Bader-Meinhof stuff, mainly.
Yes. And he wrote a very strong op-ed piece in which he condemned violence under any circumstances in which there was a reasonable alternative. And he felt that there was in the United States, that and in Germany at that time also, that that it was still a free country in which civil rights were still largely respected, civil liberties, but that there might be circumstances, the Irgun in Israel would be one, in which there really was no alternative and it might be justified, but not in this country and not today.
Let me bring more of our callers in, and Laura joining us.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 29 years old, and I studied philosophy in college. And I guess I'm not familiar with Herbert or Herbie, and I'm curious to read about it. But a lot of the phrases and stuff, it's like he's our parents' philosopher, and I think that's kind of a turnoff. And a lot of the phrases seem kind of cliche to us. Being in some cases kind of harmed by liberation, you know, when our parents are being liberated and we're trying to be kids. So
and you're suffering some of the consequences of that liberation. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
In a sense, I know a lot of people who grew up and could have had a little bit more stability from their parents.
A little more repression, maybe, and less liberation.
Well, I think stability is not necessarily an antithesis of I don't know.
But I understand what you're saying. A little more maybe order in some cases rather than chaos or something along those lines.
Oh, but I really would urge her not to be deterred by the Marcuseites, that this pigeonholing and all this, the rhetoric is not really the essence. And really read them because it is not about the rhetoric and it's not about that. It's about a kind of a way of thinking. That's always agitated and never rests, but also isn't despairing of ultimately getting at some sort of truths. And so I think that's the place to go. And as for the problems with liberation and the problems with the 60s, that's very real. And he also towards the end. Realized that while he was on the one hand the father figure for a lot of these movements, he also was realized their limitations and had a deep strain of pessimism. And I think the current world that we're living in, where you do not have so much, I mean, yes, at the social forum, but one doesn't feel this slogan, be realistic, demand the impossible in our daily lives. It feels rather that we have to fight against fascism in a kind of a very down in the trenches way. This is all part of what this thinking. And so I would say go to the source.
And let me thank Laura for the call. I'm going to go to another under 30 listener. This is Mike from San Jose, who is 22 years of age and says, I'm very much enjoying your program about Marcuse. I'm curious about the factors that determine whether a revolutionary succeeds in clearly changing a nation, such as Lenin and Che did. Certainly Marcuse left his mark on society, but what was different that caused his views to fail to completely change the nation? You want to speculate a bit on that, William Lees?
Well, these things, run their own course, and a lot of us thought that the anti-war movement might galvanize also other things that were happening at the time, including the Black Power movement, things like that, and the beginnings of feminism might produce some wider social changes that turned out to be wrong.
You left and you went to Canada during the Vietnam War, right?
Yeah, I wasn't chased. Actually, I was looking for a job, and I can tell you, in academic life at that point, no matter how many years you spent on your PhD, there weren't a lot of jobs for Marcuse students.
Well, it's...
So anyway, but
yeah, I'm sorry.
Now, looking back now, I say to myself, well, actually, from my perspective, things have gotten worse, not better. In the last 25 years in the U.S., there's been a systematic redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich. The figures show bear this out. There's more social injustice. I sit in a country which has a universal Medicare. The U.S., the richest country in the world, can't solve the problem of providing medical care to its citizens.
So I think you've said that were Marcuse alive today, he would find a government like Canada to be amenable to his ideas, or some of the Scandinavian governments that have...
Canada's a lot more like Europe, actually, than the U.S., but when I sit here and look past it, during the Vietnam War, we had the idea that you could have a movement behind you. There was a simple reason for that, because there was a draft. With the Iraq War, with no draft, I think most Americans don't feel it. In fact, a lot of them are doing really well out of it. And in the meantime, their government is busily dismantling the structure of liberal democracy, piece by piece. So I'd say, I think he'd be deeply engaged right now and out there in the streets.
And we'll go out to our other callers. Barry, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the debate in late in Marcuse's career with Norman O. Brown. Now, they both, in their own ways, I think, to put it in a sort of, I don't know, I don't want to seem cliche, but in a intellectual shorthand, they were trying to blend or bring together poetry and politics, or at least poetry in the mythopoetic larger view. Marcuse had, with his in Eros and Civilization, a sort of almost a nirvana principle of the end of radical activity. And then Brown said the creative spirit was the only revolutionary spirit. What was their, you would think that they would agree, what was their disagreement?
You're right down there in Santa Cruz where Brown was doing his seminal thinking with Love's Body and so forth. A lot of people don't remember the name Norman O. Brown, I suspect, but Douglas Kellner, I know you do.
Yes.
What was their disagreement?
Well, first of all, it was their agreement. They were both into polymorphic perversity. They were liberationists. And that means not just sexual liberation, but liberation of the senses, which takes us from the erotic to the aesthetic dimension. Both of them believed that art had an emancipatory role and could help develop more realized and fulfilled human beings and societies. I think the difference is that Herbert put more of a classical emphasis on rationality and critique, whereas Norman O. Brown, I think, was more aesthetic and poeticist. That would be one difference.
Well, he didn't have that Hegelian background. Actually, in fact, it's fascinating for me to discover that Herbert Marcuse studied with Heisenberg.
Heidegger.
I meant with Heisenberg.
Right.
Scratch of Heisenberg. with Heidegger, the great, Nazi turned out to be philosopher.
He was a great existential philosopher when Heidegger studied with him. Being in Time was one of the great German philosophy books. And out of that, Marcuse took a sense of the importance of the liberation of the individual, a sense of the concrete that you needed to ground profound thought in concrete human existence and questions of life and death and the body and existence and things.
But he was
that.
So anti-fascist. I mean, well, you know, Heidegger was also a lover of Hannah Arendt. And,
right.
You know, strange to think of somebody who was really a complicit with the Nazis.
Well, he broke with Heidegger.
He wrote.
What did he write about that?
Doug, I mean, I know he wrote a...
It's in a book that I edited called
book.
War, Technology, right. and Fascism, which are Herbert's letters. 1932, I think, he wrote some letters to Heidegger, how horrified he was that he had read that Heidegger had assumed the rectorship of Freiburg University under the Nazis. He said to Heidegger, "You were my great philosophy teacher. You betrayed Western philosophy by affiliating with the Nazis." And Marcuse continued to criticize Heidegger's Nazism.
You know, at the same time as he sent him care packages.
And he sent him care packages, and as a teacher and a philosopher, he respected him. Of course, Heidegger's Nazism only lasted a couple of years. He, you know, quickly withdrew from the rectorship of Freiburg when he saw what a disaster Nazis were going to be, and basically became apolitical the rest of his life.
We're coming toward the end of this hour, alas, and I just wanted to ask you, Douglas Kellner, about, well, the ongoing influence of Marcuse, particularly where popular culture is concerned. Maybe we can get thoughts on that from William Lees, too.
Well, Marcuse is, I think, influential, as I said earlier, in all the academic disciplines. In terms of popular culture, there's a lot of his material that's out on the web. Peter's son, Harold Marcuse, has a fantastic website that has tons of Marcusean things.
You want to give it out, or Peter, can you give it out?
Marcuse.org.
That's MARCUSE.org. And some final thoughts from you, William Lees?
Well, as I wrote in the introduction to the new book, I think his time will come again, because I think the core of his teaching was the utopian impulse, and that we will need to have come back. And there's no doubt in my mind that it will come back, and his thought will come back with it.
And again, William Lees's book, co-authored with Andrew Feinberg, is called The Essential Marcuse, Selected Writings of Philosopher and Social Critic Herbert Marcuse. Douglas Kellner's book is Toward a Critical Theory of Society, Collected Papers of Herbert Marcuse. I thank them both for being with us. Also thank Peter Marcuse, Herbert Marcuse's son, who is Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at Columbia, and Ocean Newman, artist and social justice lawyer here in the East Bay Community Law Center, who lived with Herbert Marcuse for several years. I thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you, and we're grateful for your listenership. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. We thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal and Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Sharon Adam, Christina Shaheen, Elsa Chang, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Dave Freeman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you again for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.